Thank you.
You're going to get that?
Yeah.
That's nice.
Friday morning.
Okay, what I wanted to do today, so I can move away, is look finally at the third antinomy, and then to look at the solution that is offered. But first, I'd like someone to just refresh our memory on how Kant identified the salient features of the dynamic antinomy as opposed to the mathematical. What is the distinguishing feature? And what exactly to make possible that will be different in regard to the entire treatment. Will? David?
Blanket.
Iris?
Can you repeat the question?
What did Kant identify as the distinguishing character of the dynamic antinomies as opposed to the mathematical? Remember, the dynamic ones are those that are concerning the series involving cause and effect appearances, and the other regarding relation of something being necessary and something being contingent. So,
is it that the dynamic is heterogeneous in character and the mathematical is homogeneous?
Yeah, now what does that mean with regard to further signify? And what, first of all, why are they heterogeneous? What's heterogeneous in the series? And let's just focus on the third antinomy, which will deal with cause and effect relations and the series involved in that. Where is the heterogeneity to be found? As opposed to the homogeneity that characterized the antinomies regarding the boundedness or unbounded character of the time and spatial determinations and appearances for invisibility.
Is that space and time are invisible in the perfectly even units? Or is talk about that?
They're qualitatively distinct. Cause and effect are not identical, which is why you can't find the effect in the concept of the cause, which is why the relationship has to be mediated by something else. And the same will be true of contrast of necessity and contingency. Well, what ramifications does that have, according to Kant, with regard also to the nature of the series? What sort of follows from this, or is sort of the other side of it? We'll see that in operation in a moment. Having to do with the nature of, you know, where the ideas in question figure. But remember, you pointed out that if we're dealing with the mathematical antinomies, where the terms of the series are homogeneous, that in a certain respect signifies that the unconditioned is to be found in appearances, in the world, so to speak, of appearances, whether it comprise a single term that is unconditioned with regard to the series in question, that being from which the series proceeds, or alternately the unconditioned consisting in the totality of the series. Either way, in the mathematical antinomies, we're dealing with something that is in the world. But here he tells us we're in a position where the unconditioned can be found in some respect without. And what consequences will that have, according to Kant, in terms of the way in which these antinomies play themselves out and how they can be resolved? What will be different, according to Kant? We'll see how that cashes out momentarily. What does he say will be different? Well, let me ask you this. What does he say, and what have we found to be the case with the two mathematical antinomies who, in a sense, were shown to be what kind of conflict? Analytic conflict? Involving contradictions? Or one of them must be true? Or what? What's the other kind of conflict? Or what is it? the dialectical concept, which is?
False.
Yeah, both are false because they both presuppose something, which is itself a statement. In these cases, what was being presupposed that made both of these alternatives false? That is, that the world is bounded or the world is not bounded.
The world exists as a thing in itself.
What?
That the world exists as a thing in itself.
You could say that, but what else is being, in connection with that, is being presumed?
That it's a determinate magnitude.
As a determinate magnitude. And remember that, in a sense, is connected to it being a thing in itself, because what would be true if we consider all these things to be things in themselves regarding the relationship, or regarding the series which gives the relationship of conditioned and unconditioned? If they're things in themselves, what does Kant claim will be the case about their relationship that will be different than if they were appearances? Well, he says they will be simultaneously given. They'll be simultaneously given, whereas if we regard them as appearances, as they properly should be, we recognize that the series takes place in time. Now, by the way, why, if they're things in themselves, would the series be regarded as, in a sense, a term as being simultaneously given? What is that problem? And this will be an important point, in a way, in terms of our consideration of the third antinomy and how it solves it, supposedly. Well, remember, things in themselves have what connection to time?
They don't really have one.
Time supposedly only can be a form of intuition that applies only to appearances, not to things in themselves. Things in themselves cannot be spoken of in terms of any time-ordered relationship. So in that regard, it would be a series with no temporal successiveness. It would have to have some other kind of character. One might wonder what that would be if we did it with things that are not supposed to be just for determinations. Okay, well, this sort of sets the ground. And the other side of it with regard to the dynamical principles, because they're heterogeneous, because the unconditioned can be outside the domain of appearances, what now becomes possible regarding the antinomy and how it can be resolved. Because remember, as Kant pointed out, the basic problem in all of the antinomies is that, in a way, the major term and the minor term are treating what's at stake in two different ways, and yet assuming that one can apply one to the exclusion of the other without taking account of their differences. As one thing pertains to the givenness of the condition, which is an appearance, and the other refers to the totality of the condition of, or the unconditioned for the condition, which is regarded as things in themselves, according to Kant. So in a sense, we have to recognize that these two things are different. What will the solution consist of in all the dynamical antinomies? Because it's not going to involve showing that they're both false. What will instead show?
Never mind.
It's not going to be never mind. It's not a skeptical result. It's not asking us to suspend judgment. What is that asking us to do?
Oh, both can be true.
Yeah, they both can be true. Why can they both be true, generally?
In their respective domains.
Yeah, because they're, in a sense, they pertain to different domains that need not contradict one another. They would contradict one another if one put them in the same domain. But if one recognizes they apply to different domains, that somehow or other are in connection to the same appearances, that we can handle both simultaneously. In this case, both sides can be regarded as true with the proper revision.
How are we to think about the separate domains again?
Well, one being, in a sense, the intelligible domain, and the other being the phenomenal domain, or the noumenal versus the phenomenal. And yet, they're being in connection. So we'll see how this applies to the third antinomy. And let me say before we get too carried away in the third antinomy, I'm not going to be here the rest of the week, including this afternoon for office hours. So if you need to contact me through email. But the class will meet, and do the readings that are on schedule, you know, it would be fine. and Professor Ed Halpern will take my place from Wednesday and Friday. So it'll be in good hands, and I will be back on Sunday. And I'll see you on Monday. I'm taking your papers with me. Is there anyone here who does not have a way of coming up with a copy of their paper? Good, because if I lose it on the way, okay. So again, and also if for some reason I'm not sure whether everyone's given me their paper. If you haven't, you have until about 2:15 to put it under my door.
Probably need to talk to John.
If you don't want me to wait till a week from today. Okay, let's return to page 484 and look at the third conflict of the transcendental ideas. Let's look at the thesis. Remember, what does the thesis always do with regard to the unconditioned? What does it always do?
The unconditioned factor that conditions everything else?
As opposed to?
A totality of the sum total?
Yeah, where the series will be taken in its totality. Because remember, there are always these two ways of regarding what is unconditioned. It can either be something that is the beginning of the series, which is not preceded by anything else, or alternately, it can be the whole series, which has nothing outside of it. It's just the series on its own. Okay, well, look at the thesis. Causality, in accordance with laws of nature, is not the only one from which all the appearances of the world can be derived. It is also necessary to assume another causality through freedom in order to explain them. Causality in the laws of nature is not the only one from which all the appearances of the world can be derived. You also have to assume another causality through freedom in order to explain them. And of course, the antithesis will say as follows. There is no freedom, but everything in the world happens solely in accordance with laws of nature. So in a certain respect, you can see the logical character of the two alternatives. The antithesis simply takes the series as being, you know, the limitless series of causal connections, where every cause is equally the effect of another cause, which is the effect of a cause, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the thesis is going to maintain, you know, that there has to be place for another causality through freedom. And by the way, what does freedom here signify in regard to this causality? What does freedom amount to when you speak of it here being a causality for freedom?
Is this going to initiate a set of events?
Well, going to be special about its initiation of events. Speak of it as free. How can we capture this?
It's kind of a negative sense of freedom. It's not determined by something else.
Or, if we want to speak in terms of causality, it's an uncaused cause. But remember, and it's thought of in terms of cause and effect relationships, interestingly enough. And, you know, there's a tendency to think, of course, of freedom in that regard. But if you're talking about causality, what does the cause act upon always, to speak of a causal relationship, generally speaking?
An effect.
An effect which has what relation to the cause?
It necessarily follows from, or the cause must necessarily precede it.
Well, but also it's different from the cause. Right? It is not the cause. Okay, so it's interesting to note that here we're talking about a freedom construed in terms of a cause and effect relationship, as if we could speak about freedom as being an uncaused cause. What other way of thinking about freedom couldn't possibly be thought of in these terms? Which is a maybe equally familiar way of thinking about freedom. Anyone hear of self-determination? What's different about self-determination from freedom being thought of as a free causality? Different and fundamentally.
No necessity.
Well, the self-determination, what are we talking about? What's a relation? A relation to?
The self.
Yeah, the self, right? We're not dealing with something that is what's determined and what does a determining are one and the same. Whereas in cause and effect relations, even a so-called free cause, a cause and effect are different. The causality is exercised on something else. And that means that the act of causality, even of a free causality, does not itself modify or determine the cause. Whereas in self-determination, that necessarily signifies that the self undergoes a transformation without, of course, forfeiting its identity. But these points, well, I think, will be significant when we look at Kant's solution and the way in which he speaks about the free agent. What would it sort of characterize? Did you have any question?
Yeah, that distinction between self-determination and free cause, that doesn't preclude that the self-determined free entity is also a cause.
True. It doesn't.
Okay.
But if you're going to think of the freedom as a matter of being an uncaused cause, that's where it resides. It's not clear that one is leaving any room for self-determination. When we see that the way Kant formulates it, he's going to emphasize something about the intelligible being that could be regarded as the uncaused cause. And what two things will he say about it that might be symptomatic of how we're dealing with something that does not acquire new determinations in exercising its freedom, whereas self-determination necessarily involves a self-acquired new determination. What features does he give that intelligible self just to anticipate? Well, remember, it doesn't act in time. It itself is not in time, because it lies beyond appearances. And equally, he says, it cannot itself be subject to alterations. And as he makes a point, it's determining but never determinable. Okay, so keep that in mind. I mean, here, any type of self-determination is really precluded. And freedom and self-determination is not really in the picture. And in a sense, can't be in the picture. Well, the proof of the thesis obviously is going to take the form of an indirect proof. So we're going to begin by assuming that there is no other causality than that in accordance with laws of nature, that everything happens, does so presupposing a previous state, which follows without exception according to a rule, whose previous state also is in time, etc., 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 etc. Well, how does that give us something that in a sense refutes this possibility? What's Kant provide as that which is going to indicate that this state of affairs, the affairs presented by the antithesis, is insupportable in some respect on its own terms? Well, let me read the passage of mine. I'd like someone to decipher. He says, if therefore everything happens according to mere laws of nature, then at every time there is only a subordinate, but never a first beginning, and thus no completeness of the series on the side of the causes descending one from another. But now the law of nature consists just in this, that nothing happens without a cause sufficiently determined a priori. What's the problem? Claire, what's the problem?
That something happens presupposes a previous state, but you can just keep going back because if something happened, then something had to happen before that, and you can go on ad infinitum, but we need a first. If something first didn't happen, then the whole series wouldn't have happened. So.
Well, look, I mean, the series could be thought of as just going on and on and on forever, but what does that. What is the problem of it being the kind of endless series which never comes to stop? Aristotle says something similar, for example, when he's ruling out the possibility of the value of conduct. being instrumental, where something is good for the sake of something else, whose own good therefore would have to be that it serves some other end, which its own value would depend upon something else. And so he says, you know, all action would be in vain. Therefore, ethics has to be a science of the highest good, that it's, you know, for its own sake and that for which everything else must be pursued.
Nothing would ever have happened, because what needed to precede it would continue off into infinity.
Well, what does the principle sufficient reason that he's speaking about here in a way that has empirical reality? That's another expression of the third antinomy, not third antinomy, I'm sorry, the second analogy, which he's pointing to here, which according to this argument, finds itself in contradiction with the unending series where every cause is subordinate in being the effect of something else. Well, on the one hand, everything, as an event, should have the sufficient conditions. They must be given in order for it to occur. That's the principle of sufficient reason. You know, nothing can be without the sufficient conditions for its existence being at hand. But here the series is not at hand, not in its completeness. It can never be at hand. It's always, as Kant would say otherwise, a problem that in a sense we have to pursue. We have to keep on looking for the cause of the cause and comprehend what it is an effect of, and likewise you keep on going, and so forth and so on. So accordingly, this won't work. So we have to think of the opposite being the case. Accordingly, he says at the very bottom of 44, a causality must be assumed through which something happens without its cause being further determined by another previous cause. That is, there has to be an absolute causal spontaneity beginning from itself. A series of appearances that runs according to natural laws, hence transcendental freedom, without which even in the course of nature, the series of appearances is never complete on the side of causes. An absolute causal spontaneity beginning from itself. What might seem to be a parallel of this, for example, in ancient metaphysics? Anyone ever hear of the Unruly movie? And you might think about the arguments and the situation of the Unruly mover and what perplexities it might or might not involve. Note, here we're dealing with transcendental freedom, and it's freedom in a cosmological sense. So where does it seem to be located, this freedom? Or where might it appear to be located? Where?
Nowhere.
Well, when you say nowhere, why do you say nowhere?
Well, it would seem that it can't be determined by the laws of nature, so it can't be located in time or space. It can't have a location as an appearance.
Let me ask you this. Where would it appear to be located with regard to the series of events? What I'm getting at, in other words, are we talking about something that could be said to be the uncaused, purely spontaneous cause of the entire series of nature? So something that is at the very origin of all happenings, which once the first happening is generated, everything else follows according to the laws of nature. Right? It would seem to be that that's what we're talking about, because the whole series, if it doesn't have something at its outset, it is sufficient to generate it all. It's just hanging in midair. Now that contrasts, of course, with what other dimension of freedom to which Kant obviously wants to apply this type of argument in a certain respect. And we have this sort of cosmological freedom, which might be represented by an idea of something like an unmoved mover. Well, what else is there, obviously?
Human freedom.
Yeah, human freedom. That is an agency of freedom that doesn't just occur at the very beginning of all appearances in their totality, but somehow crops up where there somehow in the midst of that that ongoing succession, which itself must have a spontaneous causality, setting off everything that follows. Somehow, in the midst of that, if we want to think of there being a human freedom, we have to somehow be able to think of it inserting itself in a spontaneous way. And consider, I mean, that in a way is not going to be necessitated by the problems of thinking, right, of an endless series, which doesn't seem to present as given the sufficient condition that is required. Right, so one might say that this doesn't quite have application to human freedom, but if you look on page 486, Kant does sort of indicate that we can be speaking here of something that could apply to something akin to human freedom. So he says in 486, right, the transcendental idea of freedom is far from constituting the whole content of the psychological concept of that name. Nevertheless, you know, the part of freedom which has always been a pain in the neck, supposedly, for philosophers, is really only the transcendental. It only concerns whether a faculty is beginning a series of successive things or states from itself is to be assumed. Now he says, midway down, we have already established this necessity of the first beginning of a series of appearances from freedom, only to the extent that this is required to make comprehensible an origin of the world, since one can take all the subsequent states to be a result of mere natural laws. So in a sense, you might almost think that we could solve the problem of the unending character of natural causality by allowing there to be an uncaused cause, setting off the endless chain that follows. And that might leave, that might seem to leave us with no room for freedom in the world. Because precisely what the unmoved mover, the uncaused cause, produces is nature in the sense of, you know, the order of occurrences. But Kant says the following. But because the faculty of beginning a series in time entirely on its own is thereby proved, though no insight into it is achieved, now we are permitted also to allow that in the course of the world different series may begin on their own, as far as their causality is concerned, and to ascribe to the substances in those series the faculty of acting from freedom. Okay, so. And he goes on to clarify, right? It doesn't mean that one is destroying or disrupting the sequence of events. As he says, here, if you look on top of 488, he says, here we are talking of an absolute beginning, not as far as time is concerned. So we're not talking about the absolute beginning that might be spoken of as absolute with regard to time, which would be that of the unmoved mover. Because in a sense, in what respect might that be thought of as being at the beginning of time and connected to that? Why would there be a connection? Which might make one think that this is connected to the to time in the sense having an origin. Beginning. What's the connection? What do you need for time?
Motion?
Yeah, you need motion, alteration of a substance, right, that is persisting. So you need the chain that is the happenings, but you don't have happenings until you've got that uncaused cause getting to work. So in a sense, that is going to set time off and running. At least time is as it can be. So here we're not talking about an absolute beginning with regard to time, which you do have in a sense with this unmoved mover, who is unmoved moving, puts time into operation. Here he says we're talking about an absolute beginning as far as causality is concerned. If, for example, I am now entirely free and get up from my chair without the necessarily determining influence of natural causes, then this occurrence, along with its natural consequences to infinity, there begins an absolutely new series. Even though, as far as time is concerned, this occurrence is only a continuation of a previous series. So be careful of what happens when you get up from your chair. The endless series you will set in motion could have, who knows what cat. Okay, now let's look at the, we'll have to see how these things pan out. I mean, note, there is a difference between these two types of freedom. That is a cosmological freedom, that is sort of to set time off and set occurrences and happenings off. And this kind of freedom that would be associated to a particular substance in the world of appearances. Namely, those particular substances that we might know ourselves to be in some respect, as Kant will later suggest. Okay? And there's a difference, but in a sense, it's presumed to come up here that, in a sense, in any event, the argument here could be thought of, or the conflict between the thesis and the synthesis might be thought to have an impact upon whether we can be free or not. In what respect could it be said to have that? And maybe in only what respect? Now let's presume that the antithesis obviously is precluding freedom. What do these contribute to the question of, well, is there free will, for example? Yes.
Well, the first version, well, if there's always a cause for every effect, then if there's an infinite series of the cause and effects, then everything we do is a cause and effect relationship. So there is no free will. We're here because there's a cause.
Yeah. I mean, it would appear that if the antithesis is true, there's no free will. What about if the thesis is true? What bearing does that have upon freedom? Does it make freedom possible? The freedom of individual free will?
It doesn't necessarily follow that.
I mean, first of all, minimally speaking, what can follow, or what it does follow, that might seem not to leave any room for freedom?
There's a cosmological first cause.
And? Well, what it causes is something that just keeps on going, endlessly. And we're part of that, to the extent that we're actual agents. So it might appear that there's no room for freedom, either. Or alternately, if you want to say, okay, there is room for freedom, you have to ask yourself, well, what is this freedom going to contribute that is not already contributed by the series that has led up to the moment when you have this uncaused cause? Is the whole fabric of time going to explode, the unity of time and nature at that juncture, where we have a kind of warp in the space-time framework? Or does the unity of time and space require that, in a sense, what happens is precisely what has sufficiently been provided for in the antecedent state of affairs? Yes.
Well, couldn't you say from the first cause, everything is substance until there's something to perceive it and so do it, like, pull out particulars from it? So the first cause, leads up to us, and then...
By the way, is the first cause, not to speak about something, isn't the creator?
Well,
creator is necessarily sort of making things as it goes along. This first question sets things off. So it reverberates.
But let me ask you this. What do cause and effect relations pertain to?
Well, that impacts.
As experience determines nature.
Well, there's empirical qualities.
Well, regular. They're not constitutive.
Well, I mean, look,
how would they create if...
I mean, what I'm getting at is that cause and effect does not involve the coming into being of substance. It involves only the alteration of the states of substance. The substance persists, and as Kant says, according to the first analogy, we have to think of substance as being enduring, without end. So in a sense, the activity of this unmover or spontaneous uncaused causing is going to be something that acts upon substances that are given, although they have yet to alter their state. And now we will have their first alteration of state, which will have impact upon the states of other substances and so forth and so on.
Well, isn't the idea that substance doesn't like arise or perish kind of convenient just for like establishing the like the dialectical framework? Because I mean, modern physics will tell us that substance can arise and perish.
But how might you reinterpret that?
I don't know.
Well, the, you know, you can accept, let's say, the reasons that I have nothing to say at this point about the convertibility of, you know, mass and energy. But nevertheless, that still sets a certain kind of... We don't have mass disappearing without the equivalent energy there. And it's not clear whether, you know, the entropy is going to lead to this cold, unmoving universe in which energy is dissipated without more matter popping up or whatever. Well, look, let's just look at the antithesis and the proof for that. Because now, the antithesis, of course, is saying... no freedom, in the cosmological sense. So we're going to see what happens if we do take freedom to be. Suppose there were a freedom in the transcendental sense, as a special kind of causality in accord with which the occurrences of the world could follow, namely a faculty of absolutely beginning a state, and hence also a series of its consequences. Well, what's the rub? Well, he goes on to say the following. Every beginning of action, however, presupposes a state of the not yet acting cause, and a dynamically first beginning of action presupposes a state that has no causal connection at all with the cause of the previous one, i.e. in no way follows from it. Thus transcendental freedom is contrary to the causal law. And the combination between the successive states and effective causes in accordance with which no limited experience is possible. And thus cannot be encountered in any experience, it is an empty thought entity. What's the problem here? What's the problem that makes it impossible?
That would be time without factor, would be. Experience that, so
it's empty. Well, what is being, in a sense, pointed to as being necessarily presented the moment you start talking about an uncaused cause, whose action, in a way, is going to produce, in a sense, the whole series of natural series? It's an act, right? And if it's an act, what does that mean? What does that signify? It seems to signify.
An actor.
Well, not just that, but that it is something that occurred. It's not an endless, continuous act. It's an act that came to be from not having been. And to the extent one thinks of it in that regard, necessarily, that means that we have to consider there being a time in which it had not acted. But if that's the case, the only way that time can have any objectivity is if that time was a sufficient reason for what follows in the next time, which contradicts the possibility of this being an action that is not caused. Because it seems that it has to be located in time, according to this argument. And as he goes on to say, to sort of bring this home in terms of the argument of the antithesis, freedom from the laws of nature is indeed a liberation from coercion, but also from the guidance of all rules. And of course, this argument is now to be directed in a way not so much at the cosmological unmover, but at any possibility of there being any unmoved movers among substances in the world. And for he says, for one cannot say that in place of the laws of nature, laws of freedom enter into the course of the world. Because if freedom were determined according to laws, it would not be freedom, but nothing other than nature. Thus, nature and transcendental freedom are as different as lawfulness and lawlessness. And this would leave us, in a sense, with all unity of experience destroyed. Now, by the way, there's one remark I think is worth looking at before we begin looking at, actually two things that Kant points to in the remark on the antithesis. He writes the following. Since substance, this is midway down after the question to limitless nature. Since the substances in the world have always existed, at least the unity of experience makes such a presupposition necessary. There is no difficulty in also assuming that the change of their states, i.e., the series of their alterations, has always existed, and hence that no first beginning, whether mathematical or dynamical, need be sought. On the other hand, he says, the possibility of such an infinite descent without any first member to which the rest is merely subsequent cannot, as to its possibility, be made comprehensible. But if you reject this riddle of nature on this account, then you will see yourself compelled to dispense with many fundamental properties, fundamental powers, which you can just as little comprehend, and even the possibility of an alteration in general must become a stumbling block for you. For if you did not find through experience that alteration really exists, then you would never be able to imagine a priori how such an uninterrupted sequence of being and not being is possible. Why is it, in a sense, such a mystery? Because he makes this remark on various junctures, that in a way, this whole idea of change, that there can be change, is something that really is not something that can be known a priori by just thinking. Thinking its concept. It's only when one deals in respect to experience that it becomes possible. Why is that? Why is the very idea of change is unthinkable? Apart, yeah.
Well, it's just that something like change or alteration, the concept doesn't make sense unless it's applied to appearances.
But why is that?
It's tied to the sensible intuition. It's necessary for the alteration.
But why is it that time allows alteration in a way in which without it, there's no way of thinking of alteration?
It presupposes a differing state of affairs.
And what would that violate if we leave time out of the equation?
It would mean that two states of affairs are juxtaposed simultaneously.
Yeah, something both is and is not such and such, which would violate the principle of non-contradiction, which is all we have to deal with, you know, if we're just dealing analytically with concepts. I also want to address, look at the remark at the end on page 489. Where he speaks of the impossibility of freedom in the world. He says, it can never be permitted to ascribe such a faculty of freedom to substances in the world itself, because then the connection of appearances necessarily determining one another in accordance with universal laws, which one calls nature, and with it the mark of empirical truth, which distinguishes experience from dreaming, would largely disappear. For alongside such a lawless faculty of freedom, nature could hardly be thought any longer, because the laws of the latter would be ceaselessly modified by the former. You have these eruptions of freedom breaking apart the continuity of the law of nature and natural occurrences. And this would render the play of appearances, which in accordance with mere nature would be regular and uniform, confused and disconnected. Well, what I'd like you to do next time is to begin looking at the sections that deal specifically with the solution to the third antinomy. And I will tell Ed Halpert to begin addressing that, starting on page 532. Resolution of the cosmological idea of the totality of the derivation of occurrences in both small causes. And I realize we're a little bit behind, but we'll somehow make it through everything. Okay, so remember, I'm not going to be here for the rest of the week. You can reach me by email.